From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Newt Gingrich and GOPAC. We talk with the New York Times' Stephen Engelberg about how Gingrich and the Republican Political Action Committee, GOPAC, were strategizing the Republican takeover of Congress 5 years ago. Documents about the plan were recently made public by the Federal Election Commission, which has filed suit against GOPAC. Also today, a conversation about race and politics with Manning Marable, director of the Institute for Research in African American Studies at Columbia University. His new book is called Beyond Black and White. And critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews an exhibit of paintings by the 17th century Dutch painter Vermeer. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Assistant Secretary of State Richard Holbrooke has assured a Senate panel that there will be a military balance between the Bosnian Serbs and the Bosnian Muslim Croat Federation by the end of the NATO peacekeeping mission. Holbrooke was testifying today before the Senate Armed Services Committee. GOP Senator John McCain told Holbrooke and Defense Secretary William Perry that Senate support for the mission will collapse if the administration doesn't make a clearer pledge on the Bosnian self-defense issue. Perry said any effort to arm and train Bosnian Muslims, if necessary, to counterbalance Serb strength will not delay the planned exit of U.S. troops in a year. UPI Shirley Smith reports some criticism of the Bosnian peace accord was heard today at a hearing of the House International Relations Committee.
Former U.N. Ambassador Jean Kirkpatrick told the committee that although the Dayton Peace Agreement is a substantial diplomatic achievement, it is also frustrating and troublesome.
Fundamentally, a blueprint for one more complicated peacekeeping operation.
She says it will be difficult for Bosnia to achieve any lasting peace because the plan calls for divisions and because so many different countries are represented in the peacekeeping effort. She suggests that Congress put a condition on its support by making sure Bosnians be trained and equipped to handle their own battles in the future. Shirley Smith, Capitol Hill.
A plane load of communications gear, along with a small group of Air Force technicians, arrived at the Tuzla Air Base today, the start of a massive transport operation to set up the U.S. military headquarters there. About 20,000 U.S. troops will eventually take part in the peacekeeping effort, and they will use Tuzla as their staging area. NPR's Andy Bowers is in Tuzla, and he says there's a threat that some fighting could reignite there.
There are a couple of potential conflict points between the Bosnian Serbs and the Bosnian government very near here, and they will be in the American sector of Bosnia to worry about. One of those is the so-called Posavina Corridor, which is a very thin strip of land connecting the two larger Bosnian Serb regions. That's been a source of dispute, and the Bosnian government and the Serbs could start fighting over that again if they're going to start fighting over anything.
NPR's Andy Bowers. In Brussels today, Secretary of State Christopher suggested a softer tone toward the Bosnian Serbs in Sarajevo, saying the Bosnian peace deal needs to be carried out with sensitivity to their concerns. The Commerce Department says construction spending shot up 2.7% in October. That's the largest gain in 3.5 years. But many analysts believe housing construction activity is leveling off after rebounding from last winter's slump. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up about 3.5 points at 5,181 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. Police in Las Vegas say they have not heard from the man known as the pillowcase rapist. Reginald Muldrew arrived in the city Monday after serving 17 years in prison in California. State law requires him to register with police today if he wants to stay. Police say they aren't sure, though, whether Muldrew is in the city or has he left town. He earned his nickname because he put pillowcases over his victims' heads to keep them from seeing him. The House Ethics Committee today met and considered the ethics charges against House Speaker Newt Gingrich. Committee members are reportedly still negotiating about how to handle those charges. The Speaker has said the charges are politically motivated. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
Sources close to the committee negotiations say Republicans on the ethics panel have offered to support an outside counsel to look into one aspect of the charges filed against Gingrich, whether he improperly raised tax-deductible donations for a college course he taught. Democrats on the committee reportedly want a broader scope for the investigation, including allegations surrounding Gingrich's book deal and charges that he violated federal election laws as head of GOPAC. The speaker has repeatedly said the charges against him are phony and the result of partisan politics. Republicans on the committee have so far refused to vote to hand the investigation over to an outside lawyer. Past ethics investigations have started with a narrow mandate, but then widened. That's what happened in the case of former Democratic Speaker Jim Wright, who resigned amid allegations about his own book deal. I'm Peter Kenyon at the Capitol.
The Citadel says it will start processing applications from women who want to attend the all-male military college. The school says it will send applications to interested women, although the courts have not yet decided whether to order the Citadel to accept women. One woman who has already applied is Nancy Millett. She has taken Shannon Faulkner's place in the lawsuit challenging the all-male status of the state-supported college. A court-ordered Faulkner admitted, but she dropped out after less than a week. I'm Craig Windham, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's been 1 year since victorious Republicans chose Newt Gingrich to be Speaker of the House, the first Republican in that position in 4 decades. But he's now the target of investigations. Today, the House Ethics Committee debated the scope of their probe. The Federal Election Commission, the FEC, has filed a civil suit against GOPAC, a political action committee that Gingrich headed from 1986 until last May. GOPAC was founded in 1979 to help elect Republicans in local and state elections. Under Gingrich, the mission changed to elect a Republican-controlled House of Representatives. The Federal Election Commission suit charges that before GOPAC registered as a national PAC in 1991, it violated federal election laws by contributing to the campaigns of national candidates, including Gingrich. Last week, the FEC made public over 5,000 pages of GOPAC memos and transcripts. My guest, Stephen Engelberg, is an investigative reporter for The New York Times. He says these GOPAC papers tell a behind-the-scenes story of the creation of the so-called Republican Revolution.
I think the documents are absolutely fascinating. It's 5,000 pages of internal memos and, more importantly, tape-recorded and transcribed transcripts of GOPAC meetings going back to 1988, 89, 90, at a time when Newt Gingrich was just becoming the whip, the sort of Republican senior member of the House. And what we see in these documents is a group of people with a vision and a question. Their question is, why and how could it be that the Republican Party has a substantial advantage in fundraising and it's winning the presidential elections handily? I mean, we all remember the Reagan triumph in 1984, astounding sort of, just defeat of Mondale. And yet, in each one of these elections, they get no closer to controlling the House. Some years they even fall behind, even as they're winning the national elections. And the Senate is really quite an elusive target, sort of slides back and forth for them. So that's what they began with. The question was, why are we losing? How can we create a Republican majority in the House and the Senate and therefore take control of Congress? And so we see the beginnings of a revolution, and we were able to sort of listen to the leaders, if you will, talking about how they conceived of what they were going to do and what their tactics would be and what their strategy was.
Newt Gingrich became the head of GOPAC in 1986. Was he the main force behind this change of focus in GOPAC, changing the focus to having a Republican majority in the House?
Very much so. I mean, I think one of the things that becomes clear, and we'll there will, I'm sure, be Gingrich biographies over the next many years. Historians will look at him as an important figure. And one of the things the documents makes very clear is the sort of primacy of Newt Gingrich in any kind of gathering that he sort of presides over. He is an idea man. He kind of sits in these meetings and throws out 10 ideas at once. Some of them are good. Some of them are clearly not kind of wacky. But at the end of the day, he is the sort of energetic driving force in GOPAC.
What are some of the things that he called for in GOPAC in the early stages of the Republican Revolution?
Well, they had a vision. I mean, they after 1988, when they actually went down, not up, in the number of House seats, they kind of regrouped and said, all right, what is it we're going to have to do here? How do we do this? And the concept from the beginning and forward had always been, the first thing we need to do is have a farm team. We have to create these young activists in the state and local seats who could eventually run for Congress. And that was clearly not all that they needed to do, because that wasn't working. They weren't getting anywhere. And his first insight, I think, was that one needed to have a national message for congressional candidates, because I think one of the answers to the question, why do the Republicans keep losing in the House, was that the Democrats were very successful in making each congressional election a referendum on an incumbent, on a local guy who did constituent service and was familiar and had built up a network of contacts and grassroots support. And as long as Democrats could do that, plus the advantages of, you know, having, you know, being able to send out mail, the congressman had this franking privilege, the advantages of being able to raise more money from PACs because, you know, PACs like to give to people in power, all of that sort of kept the Democrats with a lock on the House. So the first point was, okay, we're not going to be able to outdo them in those ways. What can we do? Well, we can have a national message, and we can tailor that message to issues that we know people care about. And so that's the first insight.
Well, that message later became the contract with America. What were the formative stages of that contract?
Well, it comes at exactly this point. As they begin to talk about how are we going to have a national message, Gingrich and his colleagues begin to discuss the notion of what they called in those days an agenda worth voting for. The name later changed. But the idea, and this was as early as 1989, and the documents indicate it may even have been earlier, but certainly that's the first mention that the FEC has of it, is a 100-day agenda of items that everybody would feel comfortable with, or the majority of people would feel comfortable with. And it's very interesting, I believe, when you read these debates, how, in a sense, unideological the conversation is. Because I think one tends to perceive the Republican Revolution of 1994, because of the people who were elected with it, as a kind of very, you know, strongly, even radically conservative set. But in the planning stages, what you see is a search for ideas that is really more of a center-right coalition. At one point in one of the memos, somebody writes, well, as we put together this agenda, you know, abortion's off the table, too divisive. And they are looking for things that they believe can be tested through focus groups and will be just automatically popular. A balanced budget amendment the balanced budget issue is mentioned. They mention other things which, you know, never came to be. Perhaps the later focus group testing, showed them to be not as popular as they hoped. I mean, one early document talked about, education vouchers, making the collapse of infrastructure in American cities a big issue. Healthcare was on the list back in 1989 of things that they might want to talk about. And we now know that the contract with America was, in fact, developed through extensive polling and focus group testing. They picked, you know, other issues, kept the balanced budget one, but otherwise picked other issues. But the sort of approach, the tactic was the same. Make the congressional election national. If you can do that and you can put together a nationally attractive platform, you will do better.
The contract with America seemed to really strike a chord, right? It got a lot of attention, and it certainly seemed to help the Republicans win a majority in the House. How come it didn't fly? How come its early version didn't fly in 1989?
Well, they were looking to the 1992 election. That was the idea. They called the 1989 sort of document the 3-year plan, which is somewhat similar to the 5- and 10-year plans the Soviets used to try. And the 3-year plan was that in 1992, as they envisaged it, George Bush would be running for re-election. They believed that Bush would be popular. They didn't understand, and who would necessarily, that there would be a Gulf War followed by a great decline in Bush's popularity. So they thought they would have an incumbent president. They thought that they could get the president to endorse this agenda worth voting for, and between him and them, they would run out all together, and the president would sort of pull them into power. He would be saying, these are the programs that I'm going to enact when my friends in the Republicans in the House have a victory. This didn't happen. As far as we can deduce it, and we did interview some people with the Bush campaign and with GOPAC, primarily because the Bush people didn't want to do it.
Why not?
Well, the documents make fairly clear that Gingrich's view of the White House and of Bush was sort of barely concealed contempt. I think that Gingrich and his ilk at this time saw Bush and the White House is largely the embodiment of everything they thought was wrong with the Republican Party, which is that it was sort of about good government, about, you know, moderate solutions to moderate problems. They saw, and this is not explicit but implicit in the documents, I believe they saw Bush as being wholly without ideas, you know, a sort of, and in this I think they may have had a point. I mean, they may have picked on something that the electorate saw as well. And in any event, there was bad blood between Bush and Gingrich. In 1990, there had been the budget and tax deal, where Bush had reluctantly agreed to raise taxes to solve the budget crisis, and Gingrich had been part of the negotiating team that agreed to all of this, and then he kind of backed away from it afterward. And we are told Bush basically never forgave him for that, found that to be just the height of betrayal. And so the notion that Bush and Gingrich were going to unite around an agenda was probably unlikely, or became increasingly unlikely in the early 1990s. And the Bush people told us that there was really no great desire to do this, because oddly enough, in September of 1992, you know, Gingrich tried to organize exactly the same kind of event that he organized in September of 1994 to unveil the Contract with America, which was to assemble all the candidates on the steps of the Capitol and put up a big sign and have a press conference and say, this is our agenda. And the Bush people were having nothing of it, and even believed, as Robert Teeter, the campaign chairman, told us, that this might be a negative for Bush. This might not work out. And I think what he meant by that was that this would be perceived as radical, sort of right-wing, you know, factionalism, and it would not appeal to the broader range of voters.
Documents that the Federal Election Commission released show that there were some GOPAC officials who were quietly talking about recruiting sympathetic Republicans to infiltrate the Republican Platform Committee. What did you learn about that by reading the document?
Well, this is 1992. One of the concerns that GOPAC and Gingrich's people had as they were planning the three-year agenda to culminate in 1992, they weren't sure that Bush was going to go along. And they decided that perhaps one way to deal with that, and this is in an early document, would be to force his hand, to make the platform their agenda worth voting for, and therefore Bush would have no real choice. And so they talk about the notion in the documents of, well, maybe we could go out and find people who believe in our agenda to run for the platform committee, and in that way, you know, Bush doesn't have much of a choice. Now, there was a woman who wrote a memo about all of this, and when she sent it to a friend, she referred to this part of the program as Phase 2, and she said, well, Phase 2 is the equivalent of high treason, so please tear up the document when you are done. Fortunately for history, the fellow didn't tear up the document, and so it later appeared in the files, and it was available for discovery by the FEC. It's interesting that in a later iteration of that document, just a few weeks later, she is told by a superior to edit out the references to the platform committee, which she does. And the typed version of that document does not include any mention of this.
Stephen Engelberg is my guest, an investigative reporter based in Washington for The New York Times. Let's take a short break, and then we'll continue this story of GOPAC. This is Fresh Air. Back with Stephen Engelberg, he's an investigative reporter for The New York Times, based in Washington. The Federal Election Commission is investigating GOPAC, a political action committee formerly headed by Newt Gingrich. The FEC released a lot of related documents last week. Stephen Engelberg co-wrote an article in The New York Times about those documents, and he says these documents really reveal a lot about the architecture of the so-called Republican Revolution. Now, GOPAC trained a lot of candidates, and you point out in the article that a third of the 73 new House members received some training from GOPAC. What kind of training was this?
Well, they did different things. They had videotapes of how to present a message. They had audio tapes which candidates could play in their car, which talked about tactics and strategy. They had workshops for candidates. And it's interesting because the focal point, in a sense, of the FEC complaint is about support to federal candidates, and one thinks, therefore, immediately that they gave money. The support we're talking about is really of a different sort. It's really, as Gingrich said at one point, we're the Bell Laboratories of the Republican Party. It's really kind of planning and research and formulating a message and how do you present that message. And the tapes are quite striking. They, in some senses, sound like Gingrich. I mean, they are, in a sense, an attempt to take the political methodology that Gingrich had evolved of being assertive and very forward and, you know, very openly associated with certain kind of issues and make them national.
Is the Federal Election Committee investigating GOPAC's training of candidates who were elected to the House?
The problem for the Federal Election Commission relates to the period before 1991, before GOPAC registered. And
before it registered as a PAC.
That's right, as a federal committee. And the issue is, although they said that they were doing state and local elections predominantly, although they said they were not really helping federal candidates, were they in fact doing so? One of the things that's in the documents is reference to the importance of supporting Newt. And one document refers to some $250,000 in 1990 that they define as Newt support. Now, from GOPAC's perspective, that's probably a very unfortunate way of characterizing whatever they did, because the judge in the case in Washington, the federal district judge, has set a very difficult standard for the FEC to meet in bringing this civil action. They have to show that not only that GOPAC generally aided federal candidates, GOPAC's very open about this. They say our goal was to make the House Republican. That's a general goal. But they say specifically we did so by helping the state and local guys to create this kind of roster of potential candidates. That's all fine, or at least the judge seems to think so. But what wouldn't be fine would be specific support to specific federal candidates before you were registered as federal. And so this reference to $250,000 in Newt support in 1990, a year in which Mr. Gingrich almost lost his seat, came within several hundred votes of losing his seat in Georgia, that could be a problem for GOPAC, because there you have a suggestion of specific support to a specific candidate, Mr. Gingrich. And that's about as close, at least that I've seen, that you come in the documents to find support for a specific candidate.
Now, I believe another document showed that GOPAC paid the salary and travel expenses of political consultants whose job was to, quote, help Newt think.
That's right. But now what Mr. Gingrich would say to some of this, I suspect, is, well, yes, of course. What I was thinking about was electing a Republican Congress, and that was our goal here. And we are most certainly permitted to have that goal. And he would say, yes, of course I had consultants who helped me think, and that was what we had GOPAC to raise money for. But so what? It doesn't mean that we were specifically supporting a federal candidate in violation of the law. And one thing to put in perspective here is, what are we really? We are not really talking about, this is not a criminal case. This is a civil action. This is the Federal Election Commission, which is examining a possible violation of election law. And no one's going to go to jail over this. Apparently, the FEC, according to Mr. Gingrich, had proposed that the case be settled by having GOPAC pay a $150,000 fine. Mr. Gingrich and GOPAC have chosen to fight, which is probably costing them more than $150,000 in legal fees, but I guess they feel that they have a chance of prevailing. Now, there is a public policy issue here, which is not trivial, and that is that in the period before they registered, GOPAC was able to raise money from a variety of people around the country and not disclose who gave how much. And the whole foundation of our federal election system is disclosure. Make it transparent. Let people know who's giving what, and we can then make our own judgments about who's influencing the agenda through the donation of money.
Newt Gingrich resigned from his position as the head of GOPAC this past May. How has GOPAC changed, and do you know why he resigned?
The sense I have is that there was a sort of a lot of opportunities for negative press for him. I mean, I think he foresaw that the FEC suit was not going to go away. He foresaw that GOPAC was going to, now that he was Speaker, get looked at ever more deeply. And I think Gingrich believed that separating himself from this was a wise move from a public relations standpoint. My understanding, I haven't really looked deeply at this, but my understanding is that GOPAC has continued to raise more and more money and become even more of a force within the Republican Party, since, of course, it's still associated with Gingrich and his people. And I would imagine that in the 1996 elections, they're going to play an important role in figuring out what the Republicans do, how they do it, and what the message is, and all the rest of that.
There's a Federal Elections Commission investigation of GOPAC. The House Ethics Committee is looking at Newt Gingrich. What effect do you think these investigations might have on Newt Gingrich's political career and his power now in Congress?
Of course, that's very difficult to say because we don't know what they're going to find. We go back to the Jim Wright story. Newt Gingrich files charges against the powerful Speaker. Newt Gingrich is then a fairly minor, shrill backbencher. The charges, by and large, are sloppily put together, and it doesn't end up being, in large part, what eventually brings Wright down. But it's enough to get a special counsel looking at Wright, a very professional investigator with subpoena power. And when he got done, he found things nobody had ever heard of, and Jim Wright was the former Speaker. I think it's always dangerous for any politician when somebody with broad-ranging subpoena power can get after their dirty laundry. Bill Clinton cannot be happy that we have a special counsel looking at the Whitewater matter. And I think the thing to look for in the House Ethics Committee decisions, and remember the House Ethics Committee, of course, is still part of Republican Congress, and so it gets a little bit tricky. If the House Ethics Committee appoints a special counsel, that is potentially a problem for Mr. Gingrich, depending on what else is out there. And we won't really be able to know, you know, for many months what this really means. My guess is that at the end of the day, they're probably, if we stick to the charges as they're known now, the various charges that were before the House Ethics Committee or the GOPAC investigation by the Federal Elections Commission, he will not be vastly damaged. I would not want to be so arrogant as to suggest we know everything there is to be known at this point.
Stephen Engelberg, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Stephen Engelberg is an investigative reporter for The New York Times. We spoke earlier today. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Beyond Black and White, we talk with Manning Marable. His new book is about race and politics. Marable directs the African American Studies program at Columbia University. Also, our classical music critic, Lloyd Schwartz, reviews a major exhibit of the work of Vermeer, the 17th century Dutch painter. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Manning Marable says that as far as he can tell, people are more conscious of race in the United States than in any other part of the world. Marable is an African-American intellectual who knows that racism is very real, yet he thinks our obsession with racial politics and racial identity is too divisive. Marable directs the Institute for Research in African-American Studies at Columbia University. In his new collection of essays, Beyond Black and White, he writes about race and politics and how African-American leadership has changed since the Civil Rights Movement. Marable says he reassessed a lot of his ideas about race while he was writing this book.
Race creates a kind of parallel universe where black and white Americans live in the same political and geographical space, but perceive reality in fundamentally different ways. Race codes our language, our imagination, even our dreams. And yet, even though race seems fixed and permanent, it really is not. The dynamic of race is structured into policies and practices of inequality, where African Americans work harder and receive less, where they go to the bank and statistically, blacks with the same credit profile of white Americans are toned down for loans at twice the rate of whites, where African Americans have inferior health care or poor schools for their children. We code these inequalities as racial, but beneath race lies the powerful dynamic of social class. And what we have to do is go beyond the discourse of black and white to recognize that it is true we have a real burden of racial inequality in this country. But what drives that burden is the social inequality of class, which exists for millions of Americans who are not black.
You say we need a new politics that takes into account America's new multiculturalism, that takes into account class as well as race. What kind of politics are you talking about?
I call it the politics of democratic transformation. The civil rights movement was informed by a strategy of integration, that is, black people being interspersed within the existing structure or arrangements of power in American society. That moved us beyond Jim Crow, but it really didn't address the question, the material questions of democracy. You have a right to vote, but do you have a human right to a job? We had the right for freedom of expression, but how do we address the serious problems of health care and educational inequality and social inequality that exist in the black community? Integration doesn't do it. Similarly, racial separatism or black nationalism doesn't do it. It's an intellectual and political dead end. Part of what has to be done is a national conversation about race and racism, deconstructing notions of race, and for white Americans more than anything else to understand that the vast majority of whites lose from racism. They do not benefit from it.
What were your impressions of the Million Man March?
Well, I think that the civil rights movement in 1963 held a march on Washington that challenged the conscience of this country to dismantle racial segregation. It had a very coherent policy agenda, the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act and a jobs bill. It was led by Dr. Martin Luther King and A. Philip Randolph. The march, the Million Man March, in 1995 differs in a fundamental way from the 63 March. First, the 63 March had a policy agenda. This march did not. Its focus was on atonement, that black men should confess their own contradictions, their shortcomings within the black community. They should seek atonement from God and themselves. They should be responsible for their own self-uplift. The agenda of the Million Man March said very little, if anything, on public policy issues. At a time when you have the contract with America, you have conservative Republican control of the Congress, for a black organization or black motion to go to Washington, D.C. and say little, if anything, about conservative public policy, I feel is unpardonable. But I understand the positive elements of that march, why it was that so many young African-American men felt a cathartic sense of joy, of coming together, of making a commitment to each other to address the community's problems.
It seems to me it wasn't just young men who felt the importance of that coming together. It was men who were older, too.
Well, that's true. The message paralleled the Promise Keepers, a fairly conservative, male-only movement. And the whole idea that the black community can be empowered through intervention by men without looking at the serious problems and the contradictions confronting African-American women pushes us down a road of sexism that really will not liberate anyone.
Are you surprised at how popular Farrakhan has become?
No, I'm not surprised at all. I've known Farrakhan for about 20 years. Lewis has the ability to put his finger on the genuine, the very deeply felt grievances and the anger that exists in our central cities, especially within the hip-hop generation, African-Americans in their 20s and 30s, and African-American unemployed and poor people. He recognizes the social holocaust that exists in our central cities.
Do you think that Farrakhan's increasing visibility and political clout is going to do good or do harm or some of both?
Well, clearly, a politics that is grounded in patriarchy and misogyny, a politics that is based on anti-Semitism, a politics of homophobia, a politics of division that pits one group against another, is not only not democratic, it's not a strategic vision that can liberate even the people for whom it supposedly speaks. The great strength of the black freedom struggle has been our democratic vision as we have struggled against segregation, against slavery. Over five generations ago, we have articulated a democratic vision of what this society could become. And in doing so, we have spoken to people beyond black and white. We've spoken to Hispanics and American Indians. We've spoken to people throughout the globe. That when you saw the democratic upsurgence in Eastern Europe at the end of the 1980s, it was no accident that the people of Czechoslovakia sang, "We shall overcome." That's the democratic and the egalitarian tradition of our people. We need to return to that language.
Where are you looking for new leadership?
The leadership is going to emerge and is emerging from community-based organizations that have not been defined by traditional civil rights values or perspectives. I'll give you an example. I live in Harlem, and over the last several years, there was a mobilization in West Harlem against a sewage treatment facility that's off on the Hudson, about 140th Street. A number of people began to be galvanized around issues of environmental racism. You had poor blacks and Latinos, Dominicans, beginning to coalesce with affluent upper-class whites who live in Morningside Heights around Columbia University. You usually think of environmental issues as people who live in the Northwest who are concerned about saving the spotted owl. But environmental racism, pollution, all of these kinds of concerns are real inner city issues. Issues like lead poisoning in the paint in the South Bronx have now galvanized black and Latino low-income people. So it's around issues of daily life, of education, of health care, the environment, reproductive rights, women's rights, education, that you can bring together a multi-class coalition of poor and working-class people and middle-income people, not around issues of race, not around issues of difference in that sense, but around day-to-day issues that affect people's daily needs.
My guest is Manning Marable. His new collection of essays is called Beyond Black and White. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Manning Marable. His new book is called Beyond Black and White. Now, you founded an now direct the Institute for Research in African American Studies at Columbia University. What are some of the controversies on your campus and in your department about multiculturalism or Afrocentrism?
Our institute is not a department. It's a research center, and we publish a journal, Race and Reason. We also hold annual conferences on academic issues and public policy issues affecting the black community. And we also direct the undergraduate major at Columbia University in African American Studies. Our campus is like all the other campuses throughout the country. There is a real sense of racial polarization and also a sense of alienation between black students and white students around a whole host of issues. White higher education was never designed to speak to black realities or Hispanic realities. And it's only been over the last generation that a multicultural program has begun to be put in place in the core of our curricula.
Now, let's get specific for a second. What's an example of an African-American reality that you have felt either as a student in your earlier years or as a professor more recently that wasn't addressed by the curriculum?
Literally everything wasn't addressed. You have the great, as we call them today, the great white males whose names are carved above our libraries, whose texts are mandatory reading in the general education courses, that African American studies as an intellectual discipline did not exist at white campuses until 30 years ago. And all that is the black intellectual tradition, the scholarship and research in the social sciences and humanities of black scholars. It's our experiment in multiracial democracy in the context of education is still fresh and new. And the best approach to multiculturalism is not to insist on diversity as divisive, but as diversity as complementary. That is, we all learn something. We all learn more about ourselves when we learn about best when we learn about others. That there is a real value for African American students learning Shakespeare. But there's a profound value of white students reading Toni Morrison and James Baldwin.
You write about Afrocentrism in your new book, and there's parts of it that you not only relate to, but you think are very, very, very helpful, very positive, but other parts of Afrocentrism that you find very disturbing intellectually and culturally. Let's get to the positive parts first.
Well, I think that even though I want to answer this question, the way to really approach this is to think about what Afrocentrism is within the context of the broader term multiculturalism. There are basically four key ideas to competing interpretations of what multiculturalism is. Afrocentrism is one, and that's basically a race reductionist view of the world or a racial essentialist view of the world that says there's black and there's white. And these are conflicting intellectual traditions. There's Eurocentrism, and in defense of that, against that, we posit Afrocentrism, values drawn solely from the tradition and the terrain, the cultural ideologies of black people. There are a lot of positives in that, that reinforce a sense of black humanity, that put us in touch with the heritage and the rituals and customs of African people throughout the diaspora. But the weakness of that is that it tends conceptually to categorize people in racial, hermetically sealed units, and that race, while it explains many things in this country, does not explain everything. There's a multiculturalism that I call corporate multiculturalism, which the large corporations put forward, and it basically says, celebrate everybody, criticize no one, and they use images of blacks and Latinos and others to market products. There's a liberal multiculturalism that dominates most academic universities, and that talks about the contributions of various people to a new discourse which transcends issues of difference. And it's rosy and it's romantic, but it really doesn't talk about issues of power. And then there's a radical multiculturalism. That's where I'm at.
What's that?
I believe that multiculturalism is a bridge through which we can engage in a constructive dialogue about difference, but we should not turn difference into a fetish, that there are fundamental commonalities that bring people together that transcend race, gender, and color.
Tell me more about how you're building this African-American studies program in line with your concept of radical multiculturalism.
You make a commitment to the best scholarship, regardless of its color, gender, or race. But that scholarship must speak to real issues and concerns within the African-American community. So in April of this year, we held a conference on the crisis of black youth, where we brought together scholars, researchers, Jeff Canada from the Children's Defense Fund, and community-based leaders and young people from Harlem and throughout black New York to talk and to discuss real issues and problems and to suggest solutions to problems within the black community for African-American young people. There has to be a link between theoretical work, scholarship, and social problems, what we call academic excellence and social responsibility.
You said that whites have to understand that the vast majority of whites lose out from racism.
Absolutely.
How?
In the last 25 years, we have seen the greatest polarization of wealth and income in the United States in our history. In 1995, the top 1% of all American households had a greater net wealth than the bottom 95% of all U.S. households. So in this era of economic polarization, you've seen white working class families and middle class families experiencing a decline in real incomes over the last 20 years. Now, how do you explain people working harder and harder and receiving less and less? So the answers of the conservatives all focus around race. And take a look at the 1996 presidential campaign. The core issues, affirmative action, issues of criminal justice, Proposition 187 in California restricting immigrants' rights, welfare reform, all of these issues directly or indirectly reverberate with race and ethnicity. And so a white working class family, which can't buy a home in the suburbs, which their parents could have afforded a generation ago, are told that the fault is not due to declining wages, but to affirmative action. If Johnny can't get into the state university in 1995 because of budget cutbacks, the interpretation is not due to a decline in public investment in education, but to affirmative action and minority quotas. That's how race is manipulated to obscure the real economic reality of losing ground for millions of white Americans.
Can I suggest another way I think whites really lose out in racism?
How's that?
Well, the alienation that you've been talking about among young African Americans, I mean, I think for some people that is so profound, and some of that is really directed at American politics in general, often directed around white people in general. And, you know, one can really understand how that alienation grew and how deep it is. And it can be a very destructive feeling, both for the person who has it and for the people it's directed at.
That's right. Now, the problem with racism is that it oppresses both the oppressor and the oppressed. It afflicts us and distorts our visions of each other. It cripples our language, and it cripples our hearts. That doesn't mean that we have forget about or obscure in any way the real impact of racial inequality within black reality and within the black experience in this country. Far from it. When I argue we must go beyond black and white, African Americans can never forget our historical experiences of discrimination. But we must have a democratic vision the way Martin did at the end of his life, Du Bois, Fannie Lou Hamer, at the end of his life, Malcolm X as well, to reach out to broader currents and colors and languages within the society to engage in a democratic project that empowers the poor, that addresses human needs, that creates the context for universal health care, and creates an economic environment of productivity in our central cities. That's a dream deferred, to paraphrase Langston Hughes, the African-American poet, but it's a dream that must be realized in our lifetimes because we are moving toward a racially and class polarized society of such a profound degree that I fear for the future of this country.
Manning Marable, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much. I had a great time.
Menning Marable's new collection of essays is called Beyond Black and White. He directs the Institute for Research in African American Studies at Columbia University. Coming up, an exhibit of the 17th century Dutch painter Vermeer. This is Fresh Air. It didn't make the papers, but during the 5-day government shutdown, 25,000 visitors from all over the world were turned away from the Vermeer show at the National Gallery in Washington. This is the first exhibit ever devoted exclusively to the painting of the 17th century Dutch artist. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz thinks Vermeer's paintings are the greatest poems ever painted. Last week he went to Washington to see the exhibit.
There are many mysteries about Vermeer. He died at 43. Deeply in debt, leaving 10 children and only some 35 paintings. Their rarity itself must be one reason these paintings are loved so much by those who love them. I'm still in mourning for the one that was stolen from Boston's Gardner Museum 5 years ago. I once wrote a poem that ended, "I've never lived in a city without a Vermeer." "You do now," an unsparing friend pointed out after the robbery. I even had a fantasy that the National Gallery might negotiate with the thieves to borrow that painting, but no such luck. Amazingly, 13 collections around the world have just allowed their Vermeers, many of them freshly restored, to travel to Washington, then in March to The Hague. Fat chance it will ever happen again. Seen together, the 21 paintings in this exhibit are even more mysterious. Why should an artist who started out doing large religious and mythological canvases suddenly paint a little street in his hometown? His paintings are miracles of clarity, yet there's something uncanny about them. Why should those brick houses, shuttered windows, tile rooftops, and a couple of women washing a sidewalk be so live, so touching in detail, as Elizabeth Bishop, perhaps the most Vermeer-like of all American poets, put it in her description of a small painting she inherited? What secrets do those shutters withhold? Almost all of Vermeer's other paintings take place within those houses. But while other Dutch painters were telling homespun stories in their genre scenes, Vermeer's images pull you in through their power of suggestion, their poetry. The tiniest drop of paint is often the source of Vermeer's greatest poignance. Like the barely visible dot in the corner of the moist red lips of the young girl with the big pearl eardrop. Is she one of Vermeer's daughters? The spot of light on her round pearl imitates the spots of light in her round, pearly eyes. "Those are pearls that were his eyes," sings Ariel in The Tempest, who is also singing about the way art depicts or transcends the transience of all beautiful things. In one of Vermeer's supreme masterpieces, The View of Delft, the angular rooftops catching a momentary shaft of sunlight on a lowering, cloudy day are as heartbreakingly precarious as Cézanne's apples. In a second, the light will disappear, like everything else in this world, but the painting keeps it from ever changing. Vermeer makes even the most ordinary people heroes. Many of these paintings seem to be about the very act of concentration, the mind wrapped in its own discoveries. In The Geographer, a handsome young man bends studiously over a map, while other maps lie strewn on the floor. In another painting, a pregnant woman in a blue housecoat is reading a letter. A large map fills the world behind her. Vermeer always reminds us that the world, which the cartographer is mapping and from which the woman receives her letter, is just outside, pouring in its bleak or radiant light. In one of Vermeer's tiniest yet most beloved paintings, a young woman is stitching lace. She's as oblivious to any observer as she is to herself. The crowd at the museum stands in front of the painting, mesmerized, intent on deciphering her miniature yet profound artistry. Isn't the lace maker Vermeer's image for his own art?
Lord Schwartz is classical music critic for the Boston Phoenix. The Vermeer Show is at the National Gallery in Washington through February 11th. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, and Alan Tu with Kathy Wolf. Research assistance from Rena Bander. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.